on a WBEN Buffalo.
Ah, Mickey, that's beautiful. The Godfrey Men, under the leadership of Jerry Alters, Mickey Gravine on the trombone. Ethel Ennis is here with Richard Hayes, Max Morath, and our guest of honor today is the CBS weatherman, Gordon Barnes. Whenever we don't know what the weather's going to be, we call him up, and he don't know either.
Thank you. I thought it was wrong way Corrigan, not wrong way Godfrey.
No, you do pretty good, boy. You do very, very well, as a matter of fact. Richard and I have a little something to open with today, called Here We Go Round Again. I'm going to open this thing with a solo on the lute. If you hate somebody, that somebody is going to hate you. And if somebody hates you, you're going to hate somebody. And here we go round again.
Well, if you put somebody down, that somebody's going to put you down. And if somebody put you down, you're going to put down somebody. Here we go round again.
If you don't talk to somebody, that somebody ain't gonna talk to you.
And if nobody talks to you, you'll have nobody to talk to.
Here we go round again. And the world needs all the love it can get. It's got all the hate that it can stand. And you can make love happen. Yes, you can.
'Cause if you love somebody,
if you love somebody,
is gonna love you.
Somebody loves you.
And if somebody loves you, you're gonna love somebody.
Here we go again. And the world needs all the love it can get. It's got all the hate that it can stand. And you can make love happen. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. 'Cause if you love somebody,
yes, if you love somebody,
is gonna love you.
Somebody loves you.
And if somebody loves you,
you're gonna love somebody. Here we go round again.
Spoken. We better learn how to love somebody if we're going to get anything out of this world. The thing getting like it is, we better learn how to get along.
Well, if the words were that were always true, though, Arthur, the poets wouldn't have anything to talk about. You know, if you loved somebody and they always loved you, you'd never have unrequited love, and there wouldn't be anything to write songs about.
Yes, but unrequited love's a bore.
Now quoting from Lawrence Hart.
Yeah, and I've got it pretty bad. But for someone you adore, it's a pleasure to
be sad.
The guy always talks in song lyrics now. I can't really say anything unless it's a rhyming lyric out of a show tune.
You do talk, don't you?
I got it bad, and that ain't good. Remember that one?
Yeah. Yep.
The Duke.
That was his, right?
I think so, yeah.
And nowadays, all the songs they got, I love you, 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 I love you. Why do you love me, you dog?
You're the only one around.
Yeah, what was that old timer we had? If you were the only girl in the world, okay, but as it is, move, baby. Move. Hey, today starts a big National Indian Arts exhibit in Scottsdale, Arizona. Lord, I'd like to be there for that one. You go for that Indian art? I love it.
I don't know much about it, Arthur, but I...
I don't know much about it either, but I love
it. Native Indian settlements like Scottsdale, Arizona is having a display.
I'm told nowadays that they're getting PO'd at us and they're not making blankets anymore for us. Fiddly D. You want blankets, you go someplace else. Which, and it's about time they told a few people off, too.
Yeah, I believe if I was Navajo, I might try selling to the Japanese market first.
Then it come back in the other door and you pay twice as much.
Well,
for
perhaps
it,
so, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think I'd kind of be a little bit fed up with the tourist trade on Route 66.
I want you folks to know that I went to a place the other week, last week, that I'm glad I saw while I was still on this Vale of Tears. And that's called Scott's Bluff, Nebraska. Have you ever seen Scott's
Bluff?
I've
been to Scott's Bluff, Nebraska.
Have you?
Yeah. What are you setting up here?
I ain't setting up nothing. Did anybody ever set it up?
Well, I'll tell you, it isn't too hard. I mean, you know, it's kind of out there in the wilderness, sort of. Is that what you mean?
It's out there in the middle of that plain.
Yeah.
I looked down from the airplane looking for the town, and I couldn't find it.
See, that's just what I was telling you, Ethel. I've played Scott's Bluff.
I was going to ask you about
that. Ethel and I were talking about all the big spots I've played in the last... You know, I just played Northfield, Minnesota, and Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And...
Now, you got to tell me where the theater was.
Where?
In Scott's Bluff. Where was it?
I played the Elks Club in Scott's Bluff.
Ah.
Some time ago.
Yeah. Okay.
I went to a very nice restaurant there. And the waitress was so wonderful. I went with Bill Smith, the cattleman. Do you know him?
No.
He's a Black Angus man. He's got one of the biggest herds of Black Angus in the world. 25,000? Yeah. 25,000 Angus cattle he's got. Mm-hmm. Wow. And he's got the biggest...
You couldn't find it?
Well, he could find a cattle, but he couldn't find a town. There's an airport there. And it has an Omni station on it, so we could find it. Otherwise, I'd never found it. And very nice airport, by the way. I took that Lear 25 in there 2 weeks ago. And Bill Smith showed us his bull. He's got a bull that's insured for $1 million.
Mm.
And it's a Black Angus bull. And let me hear you guess what it weighs.
12 tons.
Nope. Oh.
About 1,100 pounds.
No, that's ordinary bull, yeah.
Oh, this is not an ordinary bull.
Is this a compressed bull, Arthur?
No, this is the Black Angus people have awoken now to the situation, and they're trying frantically to breed back again to size. You know, for years they bred it all down.
Mm-hmm.
This bull weighs 2,600 pounds.
Oh, I thought close.
What'd you think, then?
2,000.
Oh, yeah, you were much closer than most people would be with a Black Angus.
That's a ton. That's more than a ton.
Oh, it's a ton and a quarter.
Right.
And he was the most beautiful creature. And lazy, my heavens.
Well, he has to save up his strength, Arthur. Yeah.
That's a lot of bull.
Yeah, but you know what he does? He breeds 7,500 cows a year.
That one bull?
That one bull.
What makes you say he's lazy?
Well, I tell you, he...
Let's walk down there.
He didn't chase it. Yeah.
You remember the story. You walk down, you take care of all of it. No, it's done artificially.
That's a dirty thing to do to a $1 million bull.
Well, you know, even a $1 million bull, there's a limit to everything, you know. After you get him past the 75th one, he'd tell you to go where, jump someplace.
You know? No, I don't know whether you can say that with any authority. How do you know?
No, he was pretty good at rehearsal. Mm.
Oh, well, I'm sorry I broke it up. There's a nice letter from Bob Shaner in Hershey District, Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hershey District 12. Scranton, is that near Hershey? I thought that was in eastern Pennsylvania. Well, anyway, he says, hi yourself. Okay. Some years ago, you and I had a common bond, selling Chesterfield cigarettes. I have always felt that Liggett and Myers made the biggest mistake of their life in letting you get away at such an important time, just as the change over to filter cigarettes was taking place. All one has to do is to look at what Gary Moore did for Winston. Well, it wasn't that Liggett and Myers let me go, pal. It was that I had gotten to the point in 1953 where I couldn't smoke anything anymore, and I quit. I had to quit because I was afraid I was going to cough right into that camera. And that would have never done. You should smoke Chesterfields, you know, or whatever it would have been. It would have been terrible. He said, and I'll never forget when I had to let that account go. Everybody around here wept great big tears. Holy smokes, either. Can't you find some way? Can't you line your throat with something? There wasn't anything wrong with the Chesterfield cigarettes. That isn't the same wrong with every other cigarette. It was just simply that I couldn't inhale smoke anymore. Only OPs.
Other people.
Other people's. That's the one I still smoke. Everybody else in the room. Blech. He says, anyway, I started my Hershey sales job in February of 59. Nobody could ask for a better company to work for. Hershey quality standards go so far beyond industry and government standards that our competitors sometimes laugh at us for the extra time and work spent in that direction. It sure is great to be selling such products. Yes, you're right about that, feller. I wanted to mention one idea that sells a great deal of bacon chocolate in the lower coal regions of Pennsylvania. They have a tradition of making homemade coconut cream eggs. Homemade coconut cream eggs. The basic ingredient in the coating is Hershey's baking chocolate. If you could remind the storekeepers that now is the time for them to order in additional supplies, it sure would help. And by the way, if you haven't tried our new hot cocoa mix, you have been missing a great new product that has been a smash hit. I have it every morning for breakfast, pal, because it's easy to make that way. Hershey's baking chocolate makes coconut cream eggs. Holy smokes.
Well, that sounds great, whatever it is. Coconut cream, I love, is it like coconut cream pie?
I suppose it's a candy egg, right? For
boy, I sure like that.
And with a chocolate coating on it or something? Mm. Wow. That isn't what they asked me to sell today, but that'll do.
Not fattening either, Ethel.
Oh, yes, it is.
No, only about 800 calories in each egg.
Nothing to it.
But that is one of the things, you know. We still have a few products like that in America. The Hershey is one of them, where it's like it used to be, like sterling on silver, huh? 18 carat on gold. Mm-hmm. You know when you buy a Hershey bar, you got the finest there is. There's no two ways about it. I asked my friend Gordon Barnes, the weatherman, to come down here, because a lot of people lately have been reading things about tropospheres and tropopause and all that kind of business, and we who fly know enough about it to understand what it is we're looking for when we plan flight plans, but it's a difficult thing to explain to the layman. So I asked Gordon to come down and talk to us about it. It seems that our atmosphere, just in case you are interested, and I hope you are, is made up of three or four different sections. The troposphere is the one closest to the ground on up to where, please, sir?
About 40,000 feet around the equator and around 27,000 feet in up around the North Pole.
Uh-huh.
But when you get to the North Pole, there are multiple tropopauses. It gets very complicated. But the basic one is around 26,000 feet.
Now, how do you tell when you have reached the tropopause?
I mean, when we send up the balloon or when you penetrate it in the airplane?
Well, either one.
Well, in either case, instead of the temperature dropping off at its normal rate of about 5 degrees, 1,000 feet, it remains constant or even rises. In an airplane, particularly like a 747 that's fully loaded, if he should penetrate, go above the tropopause soon after takeoff, it can become quite critical because you're asking the engines to perform at maximum efficiency in an atmosphere that it's not designed for, number one. And number two, the airplane is just big and heavy. And it's fighting every element it possibly can. That's why at times, probably when you're flying, you hear some of the pilots at high altitudes requesting a low altitude to get back into the cold air, let the engines operate more efficiently.
Well, most of the airline pilots know about this before they start out, and they don't even try to get it.
I have to disagree to a point, Arthur. I have just last week, as you know, I spent some years with Pan Am, and they had a situation where they had five 747s coming westbound from Europe, that all got into the warm air too fast, because it was not where it was supposed to be, according to the forecasters out on that side of the ocean. And they found themselves having to take some pretty quick measures to get out of it and get down to a lower altitude. So it's a critical thing and something that is...
Oh, you mean something they ran into without knowing that was coming? Nobody out there to tell them, huh?
That's true. Everyone found out afterwards, of course. It was just not in the position that it was forecast to be.
But with all the traffic that's going back and forth over the Atlantic, you'd think you'd have weather reports to...
Arthur, you would be surprised. The 747, the DC-10, is the greatest weather station that was ever built. But the government weather forecasters just ignore the data that comes in from the pilots. Now, you're familiar with the 747. You're checked out on it. And, you know, with the computer on there, you can compute wind direction, velocity, temperature, latitude, and longitude 3 times a second. So if you did it every 10 minutes and called it into the nearest station, and you had 50 747s or DC-10s doing this around the world, you'd have the most fantastic weather map every 10 minutes. But you're trying to tell the government forecast to do it, and it's almost impossible.
Yeah, that's one of the big gripes we have.
Arthur, I'd like to just bring up one subject that I've become quite involved in, and something that you're very interested in regarding ecology and environment, and that is weather modification. You've heard of the man that selected the date for D-Day, Dr. Irving Crick.
Yes.
He did that for General Eisenhower. And he's become quite a leader in long-range forecasting around the world as well as weather modification. Sooner or later, all the countries are going to have to get together and decide what they're going to do regarding weather modification and its relationship to pollution. For example, one could build a series of power plants in the tundra regions of Canada or Alaska. And then when you have a high-pressure area over, let's say, the Kanawha Valley there in West Virginia, where it gets pretty bad in the summer, you have a stagnant air mass and you have a lot of pollution, they shut down their utility companies and take a grid feeding from the ones up in Canada and Alaska that are not suffering from pollution. This does not eliminate all the pollution, I realize that, but it will alleviate the problem in locally for a short period of time.
Yeah, but it also creates one where there ought not to be any.
But then again, if you know what the forecast is going to be several weeks in advance, and you can go in there with silver iodide ground generators, not airplanes, and modify that air mass before it gets there.
Could they do it from the ground?
We do it. I brought diagrams here to show you. Oh. You ever heard of the Albert Mitchell Ranch out in northeast New Mexico?
No.
Well, we've been doing that cloud seeding out there for about 20 years.
From the ground?
From the ground. We have generators all within about 60, 70-mile radius of the ranch. And we know, based on our long-range forecast, the type of air mass that produces rain or precipitation, snow in the wintertime. We know when to fire up the generators. And these are just run by people who want to participate. And it transmits the silver iodide nuclei into the atmosphere at the rate of 40 billion million per hour. But it doesn't pollute. No, it's an electric discharge.
Oh.
And then Mother Nature takes over and pulls it up into the atmosphere. So that when the weather system and the clouds arrive there, it drains every possible bit of moisture out of the atmosphere and dumps it on the target. Now, in this chart here for the state of New Mexico, you can look at it here with me, Richard. In June of last year, was no rain in the southwestern part of New Mexico, dry in the central part. Around Las Vegas, New Mexico, they had 65% of normal rainfall. But where we were, we had 160% above normal. And boy, they had a lot of grass out there. And the same prevailed through June, July, and August, and we'll be back there again this summer. See, we don't use airplanes.
One I didn't know.
You know, you take airplanes... And you go out and you find two small clouds and you build it into one bigger one, what do? You just create a big thunderstorm, a lot of problems for everybody. A lot of heavy rain on the ground, possibly hail that can damage crops, high winds. This way we don't do that at all. We just increase the rainfall over the target area.
Where they have none.
Where they have
ordinarily
little or none.
Yeah. Mm. And that won't rob the place that might need it later?
No, because we didn't touch the system. We just drained and added to it to get as much as we possibly could out of it.
Oh, I see.
You say we, Gordon. Who does this? Is this a private concern? Or
well, it's a private concern, Dr. Crick's concern, and with the generators spread around the area, I believe one of them is operated by a gas station attendant. Dr. Crick calls him from the home office in Palm Springs and says, hey, go out there at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning and fire up generators 1, 36, and 58. And we fire them up for X number of hours. Doing it in the state of Washington, Colorado. He's the same one that also made all the snow there in Squaw Valley for the 1960 Olympics.
You see, dear friends, technology isn't all bad.
You mean to say that with a system like this, you can go in the middle of the Sinai Desert and build your plants and create rain?
If we have weather systems there that are conducive to producing rainfall, yes. I tell you, I have one goal. I have not known Dr. Crick very long, but I have one goal based on what I have learned. That if I can take one country, whether it be the United States or Afghanistan or take a country like India, and get the governments to listen to create sufficient rain in those countries so that we can grow enough food so that every man, woman, and child in 5 years or 10 years from now will have bread and butter on their table 3 days a week, 7 days a week, I feel I have made my contribution to mankind. But the biggest problem is getting people to listen and then do it.
It was ever thus, Gordon.
Yes.
It's Gordon Barnes, CBS weatherman, weather forecaster. Ethel, let's put a female voice on the air here.
Okay.
You got one, haven't you?
See if I can dig it up.
I'll say she has.
If that ain't a female, I never saw one.
Message. I can see the writing on the wall. No need to lie or try to fool me. For tonight your voice just told me all. Yeah, tonight your voice just told me all. Over the phone I got the message. And I know which way the wind will blow. I know you inside out, sweet baby. When you gotta go, you gotta go.
Wow. Oh, I love that beat.
Good.
That'd wake everybody up in the cemetery, wouldn't it? Wow.
Good.
What do you call that thing?
Over the phone, I got the message. I wrote that with Gladys Shelley.
You wrote that? Hey, golly, got it on your record?
Yeah, it'll be on there.
Oh, that's great. Where are you going now? Seattle, huh?
Yeah, Spokane area. Spokane.
Yeah, don't say Spokane. No, I wouldn't think of saying Spokane. Ooh. I learned about Oregon and Washington, Spokane and like that.
Puyallup. Opportunity.
Wallace Squared.
Kennewick.
Wallace Squared.
Wallace Squared.
Wallace Squared. Yes.
You smarty pants, you Wallace Squared.
Yeah.
Just for that, get up and sing, Max.
Well, No, I'm going to play one here, Arthur. I got
no,
one.
No, get up and sing like you said.
Huh? I can't. It's all I can do to play.
Me. That's what it is. Yeah. Me.
I'll sing tomorrow. I got one here with the band called Smiles and Chuckles.
See, one word out of me and he does just what he pleases. This is Max Morath at the Piano.
Oh, great.
That rock and roll.
Max, that was really rock.
It's Max Morath.
Did you write that arrangement?
Oh my God.
That is great.
You are weird.
Well, that's the way I play trombone. Get the same tone out of an old Mountain Dew jug. Let's close up the shop for the day and do it again tomorrow, huh?
Get to know the country better with Dateline America, a Monday through Friday visit to our towns and cities over the CBS radio network.
WBEN, Buffalo, New York.